The History of Literature podcast is a member of the Podglomerate Network and Lit Hub Radio. Hello, he's made 18 movies, and he's done it his way. John Sayles has been a leading light of American cinema, one of our most original and independent filmmakers, said Roger Ebert. And achieving that independence was no small feat, as Sayles made his highly acclaimed films in the years when that was much more difficult to do. But in addition to earning Academy Award nominations for his screenplays, Sayles is also a short story writer and a novelist. As we approach our celebration of our 500th episode here at the History of Literature, we take time to celebrate a much-celebrated American storyteller, including a conversation with him about his latest novel, Jamie McGillivray. John Sayles, today on the History of Literature. Okay, here we go. Welcome to the podcast, everyone. My thanks to all of you for joining me. We are closing in on our 500th episode. We've got a much-loved guest who will be here for that, one of our repeat performers. We have a cameo from Mike Palindrome, some listener emails, and some other goodies in store for you. And today is a treat. John Sayles is a legendary filmmaker. When I said he made independent films in the years when that was much more difficult to do, I'm talking about budgets. Independence means you're beholden to no one but your own vision. You can get around certain limits of the medium, but if someone else is putting up the money, they usually want to exert some kind of control. Today, you might be able to avoid that by shooting your own movie, guerrilla style. Back then, when John Sayles was making movies like Passion Fish and Lone Star, you had to pay for film. Film was expensive to buy and to develop, but John Sayles got it done. We'll talk to him about how he got his start, how he made his bones as a screenwriter, and why storytelling in film was appealing to him. We'll also talk about his writing. His new novel, Jamie McGillivray, is a big fun book from Melville House. It begins in Scotland in 1746, where the Highlander Jamie McGillivray narrowly escapes a roadside execution, only to wind up in colonial America, condemned to indentured servitude. Meanwhile, Jenny Ferguson, a poor young woman falsely accused, has also been sent to the New World in chains. Their fates lead to crossed paths. They are two pawns in an historic game where the rules keep changing as they navigate their way through servitude, revolution, and romantic entanglements. It is, says Publishers Weekly, a worthy epic. End quote. What a great phrase. Worthy epic and a worthy guest. Let's take a quick break and return with John Sayles. Hey, grown-ups, the Cat in the Hat cast is a new podcast from Wondery, perfect for the whole family. Join the Cat in the Hat and your favorite Dr. Seuss characters as they get whisked away on a new adventure every week. Fish dreams of creating his very own polite and quiet podcast. That is, until he gets a surprise visit to his Fishbowl podcast studio from the Cat in the Hat himself, and it becomes very clear that the cat has other plans for the podcast, and those plans are the opposite of quiet. The cat may be disruptive, but it turns out he's also a great help to get Fish out of all kinds of predicaments. Bursting with music, silliness, and rhymes, the Cat in the Hat cast encourages us all to find fun that is funny in every episode. Sing along to new favorite songs, try your luck at Titanic tongue twisters, have some fun with wondrous wordplay, and most importantly, bring your family along for all of the adventures in the Cat in the Hat cast. Follow the Cat in the Hat cast on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to the Cat in the Hat cast ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus
in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts.
Okay, joining me now is John Sayles, the much-heralded film director who has made 18 movies, including Passion Fish and Lone Star, which earned him Academy Award nominations for Best Original Screenplay. He's also a fiction writer, and he's here today to discuss his new novel, Jamie McGillivray, The Renegade's Journey. John Sayles, welcome to the History of Literature.
Hey, great to be here.
So I wanted to start with your childhood. You have such a varied and long and just accomplished career, but it seems like the common denominator here is a love for stories and storytelling. And I was wondering if you can identify when that interest began.
You know, I certainly watched more TV and saw more movies than I read books as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
But I also was reading books at the same time. And so they all kind of, I didn't really make a lot of difference between them. I started writing stories probably when I was, 10 or 11 years old.
And
I remember they were mostly pretty derivative. They might be, like episodes of The Untouchables, but instead of Elliot Ness fighting Frank Nitti and the Chicago mob, it was my friends and neighbors fighting the Chicago mob, even though I grew up in Chicago.
Right. But
it's interesting. I realized that fairly young, I noticed technique.
Mm.
I remember, a couple books that I read where I just noticed, wow, look how he did that, or look how she did that, both in movies and in books.
Yeah. Were you alone in this pursuit? Were you surrounded by any other writers, or did you have any in your family?
No, I had no idea, for instance, that people actually have paid for writing books.
Yeah, right. And
they barely do sometimes. My parents were teachers, but neither of them taught English literature or anything like that. My mother read things condensed in the Reader's Digest.
Yeah.
And they would bring home like a shoebox full of books that somebody had said, oh, you should read these. And so I was reading kids' books and adult books pretty much at the same time.
Yeah.
Probably not understanding 20 to 25% of what I was reading in the adult books, but sometimes it would be still interesting. I remember reading The Caine Mutiny when I was very small.
Yeah.
Probably at the same time that I was reading The Black Stallion and those kind of, animal adventure books. Some of them very well written, but, they were still written for kids.
Now, I can see where TV and probably films would have given you a sort of pop culture or genre element as well. Did the books that you were encountering, did you go through a science fiction phase or anything like that?
No, I never really read very much science fiction. What I do remember is there were some nice old hardback books, things like Treasure Island, that had beautiful illustrations of them. N.C. Wyeth and people I now know because I've gotten into illustrations were these classic illustrators, Arthur Rackham or whatever. And even before I could read, I would take them out and go to the beautiful plates, often color plates, and kind of make up a story from the pictures. And then when I was able to read, it was always something where you looked forward to when you got to the picture. And if they had the illustration showed the characters, that's who you would picture as you were reading the rest of the book.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds like college was a very formative period for you. Did you arrive at Williams determined to be a creative spirit and with aspirations in that direction, or did it form there, or did it happen after?
Well, honestly, I arrived at Williams hoping to avoid going to the Vietnam War or continuing to work in factories and hospitals, which I had already done. So it was, I didn't really, my parents had gone to Albany, the SUNY, State University at Albany and gotten teacher's degrees. So they had gone to college, but they went on the bus every day. And so I didn't know anybody who had ever gone away to a boarding school.
Mm.
So that was kind of interesting to me. And then college was kind of alternately really fun and disappointing. You had to take four courses every semester. And I usually could only find one or two that I actually wanted to take.
Oh.
So I'm afraid I was a pretty bad student. But you had to maintain a C average. And I tended to try to find a creative writing course so that I could get an A in it and, you know, offset my very bad grades and some other things. But I actually didn't take any history course at all. And I really read a lot of history now. And I think in the entire 4 years, I only took one literature course. And, you know, it was just, I read novels. Yeah. I went to the library and I was reading two or three novels a week. And very systematically, I started in the A's. And by the time I graduated, I think I was in the M's. Luckily, Mark Twain is under Clemens because his real name was Samuel Clemens. Read Mark Twain. And I got Faulkner and Hemingway and some other people. And I was mostly reading American authors. So I'm still catching up.
Yeah.
Caught up somewhat with English and French literature. I still haven't gotten to the Russians.
Mm.
But, you know, anything that kind of interested me, I would read. So in some ways, it was really a good education, but it was not an especially guided one.
Yeah. Now, when did you make the leap to think that you could make a go of it as a screenwriter or a filmmaker?
Just as I didn't know anybody who'd ever written a book or gotten one published, I didn't know anybody who'd ever got to make a movie.
Yeah.
And certainly growing up, I really didn't think much about who made movies. It was kind of like, oh, I think the cowboys get together and say, you know, you fall off the horse this time, Slim, which probably is how they were originally made. But I started getting interested in film. Williams College that I went to did not have had a couple drama courses, but it didn't have a drama major. Hmm. There was one professor who was kind of a Henry James scholar, Charles Thomas Samuels. And every January they had what was called winter study. And you could do one thing for a month. And one year he had a course on Ingmar Bergman's movie. So we saw every Bergman movie that existed, including the first two or three, which aren't very good. Mm. And then the next year he had one on kind of classical film directors. So I saw Kurosawa movies and De Sica movies and stuff like that. And I really, that's kind of when I started realizing, oh, people make movies and this is something you might be able to do. Yeah. I did not see a movie with subtitles until I was in college.
Right, right. That's quite a course, especially especially for the winter up there in Massachusetts.
Yeah, you would see a movie or a couple movies in the evening, and the next day he would go through the movie and you talk about how it was made and technique and, you know, why he thought it was good. And he got a projector that was very new that you could actually stop and it would not melt the film. So he could stop on a frame and talk about it. You know, nowadays that's, you know, kids at home can do that.
Right, right.
But in those days, that was actually a very rare thing to be able to do.
Yeah. Okay. So then I want to be sure to ask you about this. Roger Corman. Mm-hmm. There is such a, it's really incredible the number of directors who came through Roger Corman's shop, so to speak, and got their start there or were mentored by him. And you're among, you know, yourself included, the greatest filmmakers of the generation, just about. I mean, Francis Ford Coppola, Martin Scorsese, mm-hmm. Ron Howard, and the list goes on. James Cameron. Yeah. Jonathan Demme, right.
I had kind of parlayed my fiction writing into getting a film agent. My second novel, I was acting and directing in a summer stock company theater, and I was not available to go and sell my book. And the guy who had sold my first book said, well, I've moved over to, you know, I'm a literary agent, but I moved over to another agency. And our agency has a deal with a film agency so that your novel, Union Dues, will be in their coterie of these are properties that might be made into a movie. And I said to him, I don't think anybody's going to make a movie of that book, but give me the phone number of the head of that agency. And I called the guy up and he said, well, I didn't even talk to him at first. Somebody said, you know, send us a sample of your film writing. And I had just read Elliot Azanoff's 8 Men Out, which is his nonfiction account of the 1919 World Series, where the Chicago White Sox threw the World Series. And without owning the rights, I adapted it into a screenplay. I sent it out to this agency And very shortly after, I got a call from a guy named Everett Ziegler, who was the head of the agency. And he said, "Kid, you did a great job adapting this. I was the literary agent for that book 25 years ago. And you're never going to get to make it into a movie. There's a curse on that. People have tried and failed. But if you come out here to California, we'll see what we can do with you." And so Maggie and I drove out, and we lived in Santa Barbara for a while. And they assigned me an agent. And only about a month after we had gotten there, she called up and said, "Well, you know, there's a rewrite of a movie called Piranha. If you want it, you got it." And what it turned out is that Roger Corman's assistant, Francis Dole, had read a couple of my short stories in Atlantic Magazine, because by this time, you know, they'd done a couple of my short stories, and she handed them on to Roger. I think he read them on an airplane. Said, "Oh, we should hire this guy." So she was able to hire me to do that. And I write very fast. And so I think they were happy to get a script in like 2 weeks or whatever. And that movie was a very successful movie for them. So then I went on to write Battle Beyond the Stars and The Lady in Red for them. And then I started, you know, I actually wrote a couple movies for people I had met there, directors I had met there, who asked me to come in and rewrite their movies. Mm-hmm. So it was the great thing about working for Roger is he made a lot of movies.
Yeah.
It was just him and Francis Dole you were talking to. It wasn't a room full of executives. And they really knew their stuff. So that instead of the usual vague, well, the second half doesn't go over the top, or, you know, very vague kind of, you know, we're fishing kind of comments, they would say, "Okay, page 54, you've got another piranha attack here. I think you need to rest two or three pages so the audience gets a break."
Mm.
And so in that way, it was a very good school. And then the movies got made. It's very rare for a screenwriter to go to Hollywood and write three movies and get to see them on the big screen within a year.
Yeah, right. In retrospect, given the names of the people who were assisted in their early in their careers by being associated with Roger Corman, it seems like, oh, this is a great career move. It's almost like getting a prestigious internship or something. But did it seem that way at the time, or were all of you just trying to figure out some way forward, and you all happened upon the same
Because he made a lot of movies, because he was willing to try people who may have written in another field, you know, or done something else, you know, he was bringing people out of the editing room and saying, "Here's your chance to direct." He was hiring people out of film school and saying, "Here's your chance to direct."
Right.
It was kind of one of the few places where, even though it was a very low budget movie and you had a very short schedule, he would say, "Okay, here's the parameters. Don't go over budget, you know, stick to the script. And if you can make a good movie, more power to you." But he already market tested the title. So what he knew is it didn't have to be that good a movie as long right. as it was within the genre and it had that title.
Right. Piranha kind of speaks for
right
itself.
Jaws, you know, and obviously it's a spinoff from Jaws. And he didn't interfere, you know, and as long as you didn't get in trouble with the schedule, he was still directing some movies and you know, overseeing the producing of many movies at the same time.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think it was a great opportunity. But while you were working there, Roger himself tells a story where when Ron Howard was directing his first movie, he came to the set and Ron was having some trouble that day. And he just put his arm around Ron and said, "Ron, do a good job on this and you'll never have to work for me again."
Did you have any concerns like that? Did you worry that an association with Roger Corman would taint the Hollywood career or impede the seriousness that you wanted to be treated with or anything like that?
Honestly, that was taken as, oh, well, the person's made a movie or the person's written a movie that got made, and it was a plus.
Yeah.
There was some stigma as a screenwriter of having been a novelist.
Oh.
Because a lot of studios' experience of novelists is, oh, those are those people who insist we pay them for a draft and then it's no good and then we have to get a real writer to do it. Very often, secretly hiring that, you know, screenwriter who had some, you know, experience writing movies unbeknownst to the novel while they were writing their first draft. Now, I wasn't adapting my own stuff, my own novels into screenplays, but there is still a bit of a stigma to it.
Yeah. Now, you had a lot of success as a script doctor and on some genre pictures and so forth. Did you always plan to make money from Hollywood and use it to help finance your own films?
No, I think I was thinking more of the model of somebody like John Huston or, you know, the guy who ended up writing Jurassic Park and things like that, who later got wrecked. I thought, well, maybe I can write my way into being a director. You do some screenplays, they get made into movies, they're very successful, and then you say, well, I've written this one and I don't want to sell it unless I get to direct it.
Right.
That is a longer road than taking the money and directing your own movie.
So
when I had enough money, and it was not very much, it was only Roger was paying about $10,000, which was the Writers Guild minimum back then, per screenplay. And I had sold two novels, a short story collection, and a couple screenplays, and I had $40,000. And that was enough to make a very, very low budget movie in 16 millimeter. This is the days before the digital. It would have been cheaper if digital had been around.
Yeah.
And I had this experience as a theater director. And so a producer, Jeffrey Nelson, who had been the producer of the theater company that I directed and acted for, he just said one day, you know, we know so many good actors and you're making this money. Why don't we make a movie? And it sounded, you know, so I wrote Return of the Squawka 7 with the budget in mind, low budget movie. And then we were able to make it. And then, you know, I really didn't think we'd get it on a big screen. By hook or crook, we got it onto a big screen and it did very well.
Yeah. I heard this great interview with Paul McCartney where he was talking about when he was in the Beatles, just the joy of being in the studio when John or George would bring in a song and he would think, oh, what do we get to do with this? And he would get to think about the bass part or the harmonies or something he was going to do to make what he could tell was a great song, but to make it even better. And I'm wondering, does that sound at all like your work as a script doctor, or do you feel more like a hired gun?
I never really worked as a script doctor. A script doctor is more like somebody they send the script to 2 weeks before they shoot it.
Yeah, yeah.
And who makes the dialogue a little better or whatever. I was a screenwriter for hire, and I did a lot of rewrites. And very often the rewrites were something like, oh, Alligator or Piranha or The Howling, where they said, keep the title. Keep the creature, and everything else is up for grabs. So there was some joy in it, which is I know the genre, and it would be fun to write a modern version of the genre. I think the one thing that I brought to it that has stayed in those genres to a certain extent is if I was writing a monster picture, I wanted the people to have seen a monster picture so they didn't do the stupid things that people been doing those, you know, like six of your friends have been axe murdered in a scary old house and you go in there looking for your cat.
Right.
I just wanted the people to be a little more wise to what was going on around them. But yeah, there was this thing of, oh, wow, I'm getting to write a movie. And in those early days, it's probably going to get made.
Yeah.
It's kind of a rule that the more the movie's going to cost, the less likely that it will actually happen. And so in the second two thirds of my career, more of the things that I wrote never got made than did get made. But beginning, most of the stuff that I wrote, they were going to make it whether the screenplay was good or not. And the directors asked for me to improve the script, including sometimes totally rewriting it. And the people putting up the money said, yeah, sure, as long as he's not too expensive.
Yeah. Now, when you have cleared the room for yourself where you get a blank page and not a page that has the word alligator at the top, right. Is there a particular kind of story that you find yourself drawn to? Is it you start with a historical period or characters or some kind of conflict or dilemma? Or what is it that gets you going?
I think in general, it is some area where I know enough about it to be intrigued by it, but I don't know enough about it to feel like, oh, that's been done. And, you know, there doesn't need to be another book about that. Because the process, you know, I learn a lot in the process. And some of it's by writing and the characters, you know, authors say this all the time, but it really happens with me. The characters start to go in their own directions. And once they're set, you just write, oh, of course they do this and they do that. But also with the research that you do leads things. So for instance, in Jamie McGillivray, which is based on a screenplay that I wrote more than 20 years ago for Robert Carlyle, the Scots actor. And I you know, came back to it and thought, well, I should make a novel out of that. That was a great story. I had one small character named Jenny, and I was thinking, oh, well, what, instead of having her just kind of show up two times and be a minor character, well, let's flesh that out. And I was doing some research and trying to figure out, well, how did she get to the New World? And I got the ship's manifest from this guy, Gildart, who was a slaver, who was mayor of Liverpool several times. I'm sure he was one of their leading citizens in those days. But he also booked passage for Jacobite prisoners. And one of his boats, the Veteran, was on its way to send the Jacobite men and women on board into slavery in the, I think, either the Bahamas or Jamaica, British colonies. And it was taken by a French privateer. And the people were let loose. They were given their freedom on Martinique. And I said, oh, my God, here's this barefoot Clochan girl who's been eating, you know, oatmeal with beef blood in it. You know, and she gets to go to Martinique and they've got mangoes and papayas and beautiful fish and French cooking. And, you know, what a vacation for somebody like that. And so there is that element to it where you just find a whole new place to go with your fiction that happens to be actual history.
And why did it occur to you to make it a novel as opposed to a screenplay? Did you have more research you could put in, or did you want to expand into these other characters that you knew would sort of push the limits of length or something else?
Well, first of all, we never were able to raise the money to make the screenplay.
Oh, right, right.
Movie, you know, and so it's just sitting there.
Yeah.
And then I just thought, it's such a good story. You know, the main character goes through so many things. And I had read enough history when I was writing the screenplay to know there's a lot more there. I got fascinated, first of all, with, you know, and once again, this is what haven't I seen? I really had not seen a book that dealt with the fact that the Native American nation's politics were just as complex as what was going on in Europe. And the European, what they were up to was just as savage as, you know, what they were talking about, oh, those savage people in the New World. The bloody law was still on in England.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, you didn't just execute somebody who, you know, you thought was a traitor. You hung them until they were almost dead. Then you took them off the rope, eviscerated them, showed them their entrails, threw them on a fire, and then cut them in four pieces. The Indians didn't have many things that were as brutal as that. That came close. So I got interested in that parallel, and that I got interested in the idea. One thing that I knew from historical research and other projects was that by the 1800s, the head of the Cherokee Indians was a Ross. The head of the Creek Indians was a McGillivray. And that was true of many of the other Eastern tribes, is there were these half Scots, half Native American guys who were the sons of Scots traders who, you know, wisely said, I'm going to marry the chief's daughter. Because, you know, then I'll have an in with these people. And then their sons, because they spoke English and the tribes more and more had to deal with white people, were the obvious, you know, because you didn't necessarily inherit being the chief. Their sons became the people who were, well, we should make him the chief. He speaks the language. He's, you know, half-blooded or whatever. And so I got fascinated with that thing of those people who were the first ones to go into this dark continent, as far as they were concerned, and learn the rules, learn the languages, and take advantage of it.
Right. Okay, let's take a quick break, and then I'm going to ask you more about Jamie McGillivray, The Renegade's Journey. Okay, we're back with filmmaker and novelist John Sayles. So who is Jamie McGillivray? What is he doing at the start of the book? And if you could just tell us about his station in life and maybe a little about his personality.
Yes, he's a Highland Scot from kind of you didn't really have middle class up there in those days. Mm-hmm. He's somebody who his father used to have land. In the 1715 uprising, his father went with the people trying to get rid of the English kings and lost all his land. So he's kind of somebody who's been raised to think, I'm better than my station. Right now, he and his brother Dougal are taxmen. They collect taxes for another family. But their father has steeped them in this lore that all this land that you're walking around collecting taxes on is ours by right, and you're going to get it back. And so Jamie, because he's the clever one who's good at languages, he speaks French, he's been educated, he speaks some Latin. He's become a go-between between the Scots court, which is living in France in one of the King Louis's old mansions, and the Jacobite plotters who are plotting to, you know, overthrow the English and kick them out of Scotland. So at the very beginning of the book, he's riding to the Battle of Culloden with the bad news that he hasn't been able to get any of the other Scots lairds to bring their people out and on the side of the Jacobites. He's captured. And basically, probably should have been hanged. And at the last minute, the British say, well, people are getting tired of these hangings. It's just not the spectacle that it was before. We're going to take a bunch of these people. We're going to transport them to the New World, indentured for the term of their natural lives as slaves. And he escapes and very quickly is captured by the Shawnee Indians, who sell him up the river till he gets to what's now the state of Pennsylvania, and he is won in a poker game by Lenni Lenape chief, the Delaware Indians, and after several years of basically being a slave to them, learns their language. And when what we call the French and Indian War, which is actually the 7 Years' War in Europe, when the Indian tribe has to decide, well, you can't stay neutral in the woods. We're going to have to ally with either the English or the French. He becomes their interpreter. He speaks Lenni Lenape by now. He speaks French. He speaks English. And he's shown to be trustworthy. And of course, he hates the English. So he says, you're going to go with the French. And, which was very good advice for the first 2 years of the war. And after that, not such good advice.
Right. And meanwhile, Jenny Ferguson is on a parallel, we might say, journey.
Yeah, she's somebody, you know, what got me interested in that is that survival in that society and those circumstances is a very different thing for a woman than for a man. She's not educated. She's actually, you realize, she's an adventuress and she's really smart. But she's illiterate. She's never had any education. She's dying to get out of the Clachan, but maybe not as a prisoner, you know, in the hold of a ship where every day they throw a few people overboard because they're malnourished and there's a lot of diseases going around. But eventually she's on her way to be a slave in the New World, trumped up charges against her. And she's lucky enough to be on this boat, the Veteran, that was taken by a French privateer. And she ends up being freed on the island of Martinique. Because she's a woman, she can't volunteer to fight for the French army. And she is kind of taken in by a French lieutenant, who, of course, immediately has designs upon her. But she's taught the language by his slaves, which include one of the house slaves, who is actually his half-sister. And there are these black Martinican women. And as she's learning the language from them, the lieutenant is just horrified by her Creole French and decides to teach her French. And then she gets involved with him. And eventually things are going very well until he is transferred to Canada, which was known as the Ice Box back in France. And nobody wanted to go there and fight. He's transferred up there just in time for the French and Indian War.
Hmm. Do you think, I mean, I know you were saying this was, it had a long time on the shelf where Hollywood was not making it as a movie. Do you think expanding it out and telling Jenny's story as well as Jamie's, I mean, there are so many options now with streaming services and so on and 10-part episodes and that kind of thing. It almost sounds like as a miniseries, it would be maybe more effective than it had been as a screenplay.
Yeah, that's possible. Diana Gabaldon is kind of the Outlander series, which I've just started to read because while I was writing this, I was trying to avoid, you know, you don't want to write with handcuffs on.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no, this person had a scene from this battle, and so I can't do that. But she's done very, very well with those because it has been made into a successful miniseries. I think they're going to do another season of it.
Yeah.
But she has a skill which I do not have, which is to be able to write sequel after sequel after sequel, going deep into the history. But this, there's enough, you know, this is an 800-page novel.
Yeah, right.
You could get several good seasons out of this. One of my novels, A Moment in the Sun, is even longer than that. And so far, nobody's snapped that up for a miniseries. One thing that's happening now is it is true that period pieces are more expensive.
Mm-hmm.
As the streamers have recently started to have to worry about how much they spend on things.
Yeah, right.
People will say, oh, don't even come in if it's a period piece. So maybe they'll get over that prejudice.
Yeah. Okay. So you writing these big novels, and obviously we all know what kind of a commitment making a film is, especially for someone like you who writes and directs and edits it, everything. So I'm wondering if it's possible for you to answer this question, if there's anything you value about the process of writing novels, if there's one thing in particular you would mention as the thing you most appreciate about writing a novel as opposed to making a film.
I would say that you can be God when you write it.
Yeah.
The sun to shine, the sun is shining.
Here's a helicopter battle. A no budget.
Novel Los Gusanos, I did the Bay of Pigs invasion in about pages, and there were tanks and there were troops and all that stuff that would cost a lot and be hard to, you know, get somebody to finance. On the other hand, what's nice about working on a movie, if you do get to make a movie, is there are all these people who are working with you who have skills that you don't have. There are production designers, there are costumers, there are, you know, composers, there are actors who have their, even if they don't change a line of what you've written, they have their own take on the character.
Yeah.
And so what you hope in a movie is that you get 110, 120% out of the script that you wrote many months earlier.
Yeah. Do you think about the experience of the audience at all? Do you think I'm enjoying writing this novel because I know it's going to be read by an individual who might be, you know, under the covers or sitting next to the fireplace, and versus, oh, I'm enjoying working on this film because I know it's going to be seen in a movie theater with a group of people and they're all going to share this communal experience? Or is that too far away from you as a creator?
You have to be very aware of the audience when you're doing both of those things.
Yeah.
And the main difference is when you're writing a screenplay, you have to be aware of time.
Mm.
Yes, nowadays some people will just, you know, they'll stream something and they'll watch half of it and then they'll watch the other half. But it's really meant to be watched from beginning to end. And so if it's a 2-hour movie, you have to be aware. What happens in the first 15 minutes? How do I hook them into the story? What is their expectation of what's going to happen next? What would they like to have happen next? If that's not what happens, how do I get them surprised by it so they're not disappointed? If it's a genre, you know, how much can I diverge from the genre without them feeling disappointed from it? Whereas with a book, you know, you write an 800-page novel, nobody's going to read it in one sitting. I hope. They're going to put it down. They might even be reading something else at the same time. They may go to the movies in between. So what you feel like is you can wander around in it a little bit more. Everything, especially once you set that template that this is not going to be like a real hard police procedural that is only 170 pages long and one thing quickly leads to another. I often write from multiple points of view. And so all of a sudden, 200 pages into the novel, you may have somebody narrating a chapter or seeing what's going on through their point of view, who you've never met before. And halfway through that chapter, you may say, oh, I recognize that character. We're seeing it from this totally new person's point of view. That's really hard to get away with in a film.
Yeah.
So there's just different opportunities in each of those media that you can play with.
Yeah, it really is something we've built in. I can remember when my child was young and I was making up stories for him at bedtime, and I noticed that I would set up the story and I would say, once upon a time, there was a little boy and his name was such and such. And I would notice that if I spent a sentence or two longer than I needed to on the setup, my son would say, when suddenly, he would want me to jump forward. And I feel like watching movies, we're all kind of like that. We all kind of know, like, hey, this is, we're getting a little too much backstory here. What's going to happen here? And novels, we don't feel that way. We just settle in and take the pace as it comes to us.
Yeah, especially if you get intrigued by the characters or the setting or something like that. So it's something you have to be very aware of with the audience. And then I ask a lot of the audience, I ask the audience to connect the dots very often. And I'm not going to underline things. I tend not to use typical Hollywood underlining music in my movies that tell you how I feel. In my fiction, I don't have a whole lot of interior monologue. It's more what people say and what they do. And you figure out what's going on in their head from what they say and what they do. So in some ways, my books are a little more cinematic than other people who might get, might go 17 pages like Faulkner into what a character is thinking in four sentences in his case. But you do have to be aware. I'm writing this for people. Jamie McGillivray, there is untranslated French in it. There's a lot of dialect. And so I go over that. And when it's a language and I'm not translating it, I try to have words in it that sound just like their English counterpart. So explosif and explosives are the same. So if somebody says that in French, you realize, oh, they're talking about explosives. And very often I'll have a question asked in French or Gaelic, and then the answer will be in English. And so from the context, you understand what's going on. So you're not writing for yourself because you know too much.
Right, right.
You have to constantly, what does the reader need to know? What does the audience need to know to proceed with a story?
Yeah. After writing a book like this with this many pages and the amount of time you spent with it and so on, could you turn it over to another filmmaker to bring to the screen, or would you feel like you needed to stay involved?
It would depend on who the filmmaker is.
Yeah.
I had a short story that I could never get to work as a short story. I wrote it as a screenplay, and I really liked the screenplay, but I felt like I don't need to direct this one. And eventually, Bill Forsyth, the Scots director, made it into a pretty good movie. And, so I have done that. So I don't know. Certainly if Jamie McGillivray got made into a miniseries, I would not write or direct every episode.
Yeah.
Way too much work.
Right. Well, let's leave things there. The author is John Sayles, acclaimed film director and novelist, and the book is called Jamie McGillivray, The Renegade's Journey. John Sayles, thank you for joining me on the History of Literature.
Thank you.
Okay, that's going to do it for this episode of The History of Literature. My thanks to John Sayles for joining me. Do check out his book. It's a good, we've got Father's Day coming up, Mother's Day. Think about putting a copy in the hands of your beloved mother or father or your spouse.
or someone else who likes a good story. Intelligent and rollicking. A worthy epic. Maybe you would like to read that yourself. Jamie McGillivray. Okay, people. Are you getting your party hats and favors ready? We have episode 500 coming up. I will probably be indulging myself a bit. Fair warning, we will try to have a good time. All literature-based, of course. Next up, though, Thursday, we've got Laura Lee, who will join us for a look at a mysterious figure adjacent to Oscar Wilde, a gentleman thief and huckster who was part of an international spy ring. We'll hear who he was, how he intersected with Mr. Wilde, and how he kept his own name out of Oscar Wilde's trial. It helps to have connections. And to be devious. Sometimes, maybe. Not that I would know. Speaking of connections, I'm glad you found our podcast and that we were able to connect like this today, and I hope you come back for more. I'm Jack Wilson. Thank you for listening. And we'll see you next time. Thank you.